This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, Aaron Wren of The American Conservative, and others for the 2024 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, July 12th and 13th in Chicago. issuesetc.org.
The creed of modern paganism is essentially nothing is objectively true. We've heard that before. Everyone has their own truth. And everything is permissible. We've seen it before in pre-modern forms of paganism, and now it's on the rise again, along with the decline of the influence of Christianity. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We interviewed John Daniel Davidson last Friday about the paganization of America. John is senior editor at The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. We discuss several topics, including that definition of paganism and why it is that in America we are finding the decline of Christianity coincide with the rise of this new paganism. Let's pick up where we left off with John's answer to my question, why are abortion and euthanasia considered sacred in a pagan society?
Yeah, I have a chapter on abortion and euthanasia as essentially human sacrifice in the new pagan cults. And the reason for it is because it engages a pagan ethos, a pagan view of the world that we mentioned earlier about power, that power rightly belongs to the powerful, and the weak have no right to power or protection, only at the indulgence of the powerful. It's easy to see this in something like abortion, where obviously the most powerless people in our society, the unborn, and the people who have most power over the unborn are the pregnant mothers who choose to end the life and kill their unborn children. We also see it with euthanasia, because euthanasia is the killing of the second least powerful group in the country, which is the aged and infirm. And so it's easy to see, and I track this in the chapter that deals with this, how the justifications for these things have changed over time, and they've become more explicitly about the exercise of will and power and less about gauzy notions of scientific materialism. It's easy to see this in the abortion debate, the justification that an unborn child was just a fetus, it was a clump of cells, it wasn't really alive, almost immediately was undermined by advances in medical technology that proved pretty definitively that this wasn't just a clump of cells. This was an independent human being. And the age of viability kept moving backwards to earlier and earlier. So even the justifications for Roe v. Wade, not very long after that Supreme Court decision, were rendered obsolete by advances in medical technology, because the age of viability, of course, kept getting younger and younger. And so the justifications for abortion had to change. And I kind of go through and track how they changed through the 80s and 90s and then into the 21st century. And now the justifications for abortion are not tied to gestational age or viability or anything like that. All of that's gone now. The justifications that the pro-abortion movement and pro-abortion advocates argue for now are based entirely upon the will of the mother. If the mother wants to keep the baby, then the baby is human being, is entitled to rights and protections. If the mother doesn't want to keep the human being, it's entitled to nothing. It has no rights and no protections. And this absurd situation, again, the disfigurement of reason is a hallmark of neo-paganism, has resulted in policies where an unborn child, two unborn children, the same gestational age, can be considered a citizen and a human being who needs protection and who's entitled to medical care in one state and has no protections and can be essentially birthed alive and then killed at the last minute in another state. Same age. The only difference is what the mother wills. This to me is thoroughly pagan. It's a thoroughly pagan way of approaching the question of whether or not abortion should be legal or what status an unborn child should have. And we see something similar playing out in the euthanasia debate. And for that, I look to Canada, which has had massive growth over the last several years, euthanasia program. And we see there the same kind of progression from, oh, this is about giving people with terminal diseases a way to die a dignified death. Quickly, that debate has moved on from that. And now this is about reducing healthcare costs for the National Health Service. This is about giving people who require costly substance abuse treatments a cheaper option to off themselves. It's about getting rid of dementia patients who require a very high, intense level of care. And it's not like it took decades and decades. This has happened in a matter of years. And I talk about that at some length in the book.
How do transgenderism and pedophilia fit into modern paganism?
Yeah, that's another chapter that I deal with in the book, transgenderism and pedophilia. And I don't put those things together to suggest that all transgender people are pedophiles. That's not the connection. The connection is both of those things require a radical rejection of reason and an elevation of will and desire over reason. And those, again, are hallmarks of neo-paganism. And with the case of transgenderism, there's an added element of wanting to and believing that we can sort of create ourselves, a rejection of the givenness of nature, right? And that goes hand in hand with the rejection of reason, right? Because reason helps us to understand true things about the natural world, about the objective world outside of ourselves. Transgenderism and arguably transhumanism, which I also talk about, is a rejection of that view of reality, that reality is objectively real, that we can know true things about it, and that reason can be our guide in the acquisition of knowledge about the world. Transgenderism posits a different sort of standard for truth, which is just what I personally will. And what I will and what is true for me does not have to be in accord. It does not have to reconcile with any exterior or objective truth. It's sort of a radical relativism. And it's the same kind of relativism that is pushing a movement started in academia, as many of these movements do, to legitimize pedophilia or sexual relationships between adults and minors. That the rejection of reason, the rejection of objective truth means also the rejection of objective moral truth. You know, you can't say that it's just objectively wrong for an adult to have a sexual relationship with a child. And they are working very hard to come up with justifications for this. They are still using language inherited from liberalism, which is to say also inherited from the Christian past, to justify it. But the reality is that they're very quickly moving to discard those things and embrace a view of not just transgenderism, but a view of pedophilia as legitimate because the person in question, that is their truth, that is their identity, and there is no basis on which to deny them their truth and their identity and their pursuit of happiness as they see fit.
Is transgenderism a cult?
It certainly functions like a cult, and the best exposition of that is Abigail Schreier's book from a few years ago. The name escapes me now, but it certainly seems to function like a cult, that once you become part of this sort of community, oftentimes it begins online, you are told that the only people who love you and care about you are within the transgender community. You can't trust your parents. You can't trust your friends or your church leaders. If they don't accept your trans identity, they don't really love you. You have to break all ties with them, which is a very cult-like pattern we see in all different kinds of cults, and expel and expunge anyone from your life that doesn't affirm you in this new set of beliefs about yourself and about reality. And then anyone who then subsequently questions their trans identity or decides to detransition is totally cut off from the community. cast out from the cult, we might say. And this is consistent with a view of transgenderism, that it's not something that arises from like a secular, rational, scientific, materialist worldview. It arises from a post-Christian pagan worldview where they are kind of creating their own reality. It's not based on anything objective. It's totally subjective. And again, it's totally about desire and will and power.
What does the post-Christian state, you say post-Christian pagan state, we're living in it right now, what does it look like?
Yeah, one of the final chapters concerns the pagan state. And what I argue is that as we jettison reason and rationality and any sense of objective truth or objective reality, not to mention objective moral truth, that the state, that is to say the government at all levels, will increasingly adopt that same approach and apply it to political questions and policy questions, so that the idea that the state would be neutral, right? To go back to this idea of neutrality, would be neutral when it comes to something like free speech, you know, not discriminating based on viewpoint. It's going to shed that neutrality because there won't be any reason for it anymore. There won't be any point to maintain neutrality because there is no objective truth anymore. There's only what the state wants. And we see this playing out right now more and more, that if you express opinions or ideas or even publicize facts that run contrary to a narrative or a policy that the state wants to enact or a narrative it wants to push, state will come after you. Right now, it's taking the form of the uneven application of otherwise neutral laws. But if you continue to unevenly apply neutral laws for long enough or consistently enough, pretty soon everybody figures out that these aren't neutral laws. This is just the naked exercise of power over and against the people who are deemed the state. And that's a form of paganism. Because again, as we talked about in the first part of this conversation, paganism wasn't just a polytheism, right? It wasn't just a set of religious rituals. It was a whole way of organizing society. It was a whole way of using anxiety and fear and power to control people. That's what the pagan empires were. That's why pagan societies, when they developed to a high level of sophistication, all took on the same form, which is that of a slave empire, where most of the people in those societies were slaves, and they were ruled over by a small number of aristocrats or clerics or nobles. And that pattern repeats itself across time and geography throughout the pagan past. And it's a form of society that is taking shape now in a modern context as Christianity retreats.
Power must have the threat of force behind it. Why do you say that there is violence in America's future?
Well, precisely because the raw exercise of power does require the use of force. But more broadly speaking, pagan societies relied on violence to impose the will of those who ruled, right? If the basis for power is not the consent of the governed, which is what it was in America all this time, that was the idea, the legitimate power of the government would be derived from the consent of the people. And you only care about something like consent if you have something like Imago Dei, the doctrine that people inherently have dignity, they inherently have rights, they inherently have worth, and you cannot justly govern them except by their consent. When you get rid of that idea of the inherent dignity and worth of human beings, you lose the basis for consent. There's no reason to obtain the consent of the governed. And so the power of the government derives from something else at that point. It's not going to be derived from the consent of the people who are being governed. It's going to be derived from the use of violence and coercion over and against the people who are being ruled. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that play out. Again, we still use the language, that it was inherited from Christianity to talk about the government and its exercise of powers. But the idea that the government is going to be some neutral enforcer of just laws is a fiction, quite frankly, and it's a cope. And we need to be prepared and very clear-eyed about what's going to happen as we reject Christianity and the claims that it makes about the human person and the basis for a just government. We're going to have a new basis for government, and it's not going to be based on the idea that everyone has inherent dignity and worth and rights.
John Daniel Davidson is our guest, senior editor of The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. We'll find out why a pagan state needs to regulate not only speech, but thought and belief next.
So if you think that, you know, you still live in a country where there's going to be some respect for your beliefs, you know, you could end up, you know, on the wrong end of a criminal prosecution.
Aaron Wren of the American Conservative talking about his presentation at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so that might be, of course, unfair or in many ways, but it's also reality. If you don't understand the changes that have happened in the world, then you're not going to be able to make sense of what you see around you. And again, you might actually disadvantage yourself by taking actions that 20, 30 years ago would have been no big deal, but today might destroy your life.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wren making the case for Christianity in a negative world at this year's Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. You'll find additional information, and you can register at issuesetc.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The LCMS operates the second largest parochial school system in the United States. What can you expect from a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school? There's one race, the human race. And Jesus died for the sins of every man, woman, and child from every land and every nation. Life begins at conception. All life is precious from womb to tomb. And every student, parent, and teacher is created in the very image of God. There's right and wrong, and we know which is which from the Ten Commandments. There are only two sexes, male and female, He created them. Marriage is the lifelong union of one man and one woman. There's such a thing as objective, absolute truth, and it's found in the person and work of Jesus Christ and His Word. To find a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school near you, visit lcms.org/schools.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump Drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the paganization of America. John Daniel Davidson is our guest, senior editor at The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. Folks, if you're looking to protect your children from the paganization of America, consider sending them to a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school. The LCMS operates the second largest parochial school system in the U.S., You can find a Lutheran school near you. Just visit lcms.org/schools, lcms.org/schools. John, why must a pagan state regulate not only speech, but also thought and belief?
One reason is that if you're going to impose a societal rule that's based on force and power and will, and impose a kind of radical subjectivism and subjective morality and the subjective exercise of power, then you need everybody to be on the same page. You can't have people dissenting, right? A really potent example of this would be something like child sacrifice. If you're going to commit these atrocities, then you can't have a small group of people standing on the outside saying, this is an atrocity, what you're doing. You can't allow for that kind of dissent. Not only can you not allow for that kind of dissent, like verbal dissent or civil disobedience, as it were, you can't even allow for the thought to persist. Everyone has to be on the same page in order for this kind of society to work, which is why pagan societies in the past had no tolerance for dissent, whether it was a very advanced Roman Empire that could not tolerate Christian dissent, even private Christian practice, or something, you know, rather more bloody like the Aztec Empire, which very clearly had no room for dissent, right? But you see this over and over, so that the control of anxiety and fear among a people, which is one of the things that a pagan society attempts to do, requires that everyone agree. That's why the Romans were so insistent that the Christians offer just a pinch of incense to Caesar. They didn't have to believe that Caesar was a god man. Very few Romans actually believed that Caesar was really a god. But it was important for everyone to sort of act as though Caesar was a god. It was important for the ritual to be done, for the Christians to offer the pinch. You just offer the pinch and we'll leave you alone. Because they had to have uniformity, even if it was just in a nominal sense. They couldn't afford that kind of dissent from the Christians. And so when the Christians wouldn't offer the pinch of incense to Caesar, they had to crush them. They had to persecute them in really violent, unimaginably violent ways. And this is a pattern that we see throughout. And so to connect it to what's happening now, you see in some Western societies this idea coming up again that it's not enough to just control speech. You have to control thought too. And this is connected to the debate over misinformation, right? We can't allow people to see misinformation online, to have wrong ideas or wrong thoughts about our elections or about transgender people or about much else. But you also see it in actual laws that are coming into being in Europe and in the United Kingdom against, for example, praying silently outside an abortion clinic. There's laws on the books now in Ireland and Britain that if you are praying, you know, like within a certain distance of an abortion clinic, even if you're just standing praying silently, and the police approach you and ask you if you're silently praying, if you tell them that you are, they will arrest you. They will use force. And if you resist the arrest, then of course they'll use violence. I mean, this is happening. This is a law that has been passed in various countries in Europe that's on the books. So we kid ourselves if we think that the post-Christian era and the kind of post-Christian societies that are coming into being right now are not going to very quickly devolve into modern versions of their pagan forerunners.
What cost will the technology of artificial intelligence exact from us?
One of the last chapters in the book is on artificial intelligence. And I argue in that chapter that the emergence of AI is one of the most straightforwardly pagan developments of the post-Christian era. Part of it is in the way that the architects of AI talk about what it is that they're doing. They're really open about the idea that in their minds, they're creating something like a god. It's a kind of a Tower of Babel project for them to harness unimaginable power through this new technology and then turn the organization of society over to those powers. It's hard to imagine a better example of what we might mean by modern paganism or neo-paganism than the emergence of AI. I think there's a few people who come out and say it explicitly, and I talk about one of them at length in the book, that these AIs will become so powerful that we won't be able to resist them, and we will need to turn over a lot of our decision-making and a lot of the decisions that we make, just even not just at a societal level, but on the individual level, over to these AIs that will be like new powerful overlords. And the cost of that is almost incalculable for what it will do, not just for the idea of a self-governing society or of individual liberty, let's say, but what it will do in terms of our relationships with one another, in terms of our how we organize our communities and how we practice religion.
What is the Boniface option?
The Boniface option is the title of the last chapter of the book, and I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here. It's a reference to Rod Dreher's Benedict option, and I discuss the Benedict option at length in that chapter, not entirely in a critical way. I think the Benedict option got a lot right, and it was very prescient at the time that it came out. But it came out in 2017, and I think even Rod Dreher would be surprised at how quickly things have moved since 2017, how bad things have gotten, how quickly. The Boniface option is a way to reconceptualize much of what Roger was talking about in the Benedict option, and I would say add to it. Rightly or wrongly, one of the impressions that people got from the Benedict option was that what was required for Christians to survive in the sort of the world that was coming into being, that is now coming into being, is a retreat from the world into Benedictine-like communities of solidarity, where you could run your home like a monastery, you could mutually support one another in economic and professional life, where you could build a kind of ark to survive the flood. What I'm proposing is that that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. We also have to have a kind of Boniface option. Saint Boniface, of course, was the apostle to the Germans. He was a medieval churchman, great missionary to the Franks and to the Saxons, who at the time, the Saxons and the German tribes were pagan during St. Boniface's lifetime. And he made it his mission in life to proselytize them and to bring them the truth of Christianity. And he did it in a bold way. He famously cut down a sacred oak tree of the Saxons while a group of outraged pagans looked on. He cut it down and he used the timbers to build a chapel to St. Peter. And I say I invoke him because we need to fight back as Christians. We need to rediscover a more muscular and assertive form of Christianity. And by that I mean, find ground you can fight on and win on, right? Find ground where you can win. So it's not enough to have your Christian community and your church community and your private school and survive. We need to move to towns and communities where we can take back the city council, where we can take back the library, where we can take back the school board, where we can fight and win and carve out a space in the public square for our Christian faith and for the kind of Christian community that we know is necessary for flourishing and prosperity. We cannot just content ourselves to be sequestered in kind of Benedictine safety inside sort of monasteries of our own creation. We have to take our faith out to the public square and insist on carving out a space for it, and insist that as far as we are able in our communities, public morality and the civic square will be shaped and informed by Christian morality and Christian principles. That's the Boniface option.
What do you say to Christians listening to us who think that you're being alarmist when you warn about a pagan America and its future?
Well, I implore them, number one, to read the book, because I think the purpose of the book is to help those people who think I'm being alarmist to see that it's not alarmist, to help them open their eyes and admit to themselves what's happening. I can see being criticized for this book that I don't offer enough in the way of solution, but my primary purpose in writing this book is not to offer a solution, these 10 steps to save America. My primary purpose is to get Christians to realize what time it is, to accept that we are entering a post-Christian era, and to understand what that means, what that will bring, and that the long truce everyone alive has enjoyed, and indeed everyone going back several generations in America, enjoyed a kind of truce between secularism and Christianity, in which Christianity was left alone because we're still living off of the capital of Christendom. My message to Christians who think I'm being alarmist is that capital is running out. We are not going to be able to live off of the inheritance of a Christianity that is being rejected and is being slewed off right now. What's coming into being is going to be a different kind of society. It's a society that's going to be actively hostile to Christian belief and Christian practice and Christian community. And I think that the first step is just to admit to ourselves what's happening and to understand that it means profound changes in American life and society.
John Daniel Davidson is senior editor at The Federalist. He's author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity in the Dark Age to Come. You'll find a link to this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. John, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll visit with Tim Barnett and Alyssa Childers, co-authors of the new book, The Deconstruction of Christianity. We'll look forward to Easter Sunday morning, according to the three-year lectionary, with Pastor Sean Denzer, and we'll respond to your email in the Issues Etc. comment line. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
The Lord has redeemed His people.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live, weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues Etc.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcasts weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the Master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, freedom, vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
The substitute organist service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the substitute organist service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the substitute organist service at churchmusicsolutions.com. churchmusicsolutions.com.